Okay, we are recording the review lesson for Sefer Melachim, Aleph, Part 1, which has been running during the fall semester of 2018. Good Lord, 2018, my goodness. Okay, now, before we get into the subject matter on the review sheet, I just want to talk about a couple of general things. Hi there. A couple of things about exam. General things about the exam. Number one, most important thing is read the exam paper carefully. Sort of thing everybody says, very boring, but has to be said because that's what teachers do, right? You know, you get paid to tell you to do all these boring things, and that's one of them. Hopefully the rest of the stuff is not so boring. Read every question carefully. Most questions are in parts, which means that if you do a question very well, but it has three parts and you've only answered two, so I can give you full points on two parts, but it doesn't help me if I want to give you full points on the whole question. If you miss out a section, then unfortunately I can't give you any points for that section. So please read each section carefully and answer every section. Even if you're not sure, better to write something than nothing. That's usually the rule. In terms of the exam, it's 5 out of 6 questions. They can be done in any order. Okay, so again, I want to make that absolutely clear. They can be answered in any order that you wish. Okay, obviously make clear which question you're answering. You know, do it the way you're supposed to. Please, when you're using those rather unpleasant little books, which I've never been a big fan of, on the front cover, just write your name as one would. Inside the book, use the white pages inside, but not the covers. Okay, if you've got a few sentences to finish off an answer, don't write it on the back cover, but take another book, be brave, and use a second book. It's not the end of the world, and it makes life so much more straightforward for me. I talk about this young lady who's now probably not so young anymore. I'm not sure, I don't think it was my daughter, but it may have been someone in her class, going back a long time ago, who did a whole question on the back cover, starting on the inside back cover, the blue cover, and finishing with literally 1 millimeter to spare on the outside. Brilliant. Totally brilliant, but absolutely not the sort of thing that I was too enamored with, even though it was pretty amazing how she did it. I have to say, please don't do that. Not a good idea. So stay within the books. Make it neat, tidy, you know, all the stuff that would endear you to your professor, to your teacher, that I can read it. Please, pen or pencil, ideally pen, but something clear. Leave at home all of your psychedelic pens, if that's the word we use these days, probably don't. All the colours that are not good for anything else but viewing things at night time. I literally once had a paper which was written in a colour which I could only read in the dark. So couldn't read it in daytime. It was just too, you know, it was one of those light colours. I had to read in the dark. Again, not a great idea. Avoid all of that stuff. Leave those pens at home. But come with a spare pen, right? Make sure you have a couple of things that, in case your pen runs out, whatever, you know, just be prepared. I'm not sure when this exam is. I think it's either Tuesday or the Thursday. Is third, which is a Thursday. So, okay, 1 o'clock, right? It's a 2-hour paper. It's, again, 5 out of 6 questions, no heroics. Don't do 6, expecting a bit of extra credit. That doesn't happen at this level. At this level, do 5, sign your paper in, and then you go and whatever you do in preparation for Shabbat, but you're out of the room. You're gone. Okay? Yes, very quick question. No, absolutely not advisable. 5 out of 6. The 6th one will just get a line through it. There's too many papers that I have to grade. In a very short space of time, I will not be able to grade 6 answers. So whatever the 6th answer is, we'll just get it could be your best answer. You're going to have to make that judgment, which questions I do. That's part of the test when you think about it. So if you do 6, hedging your bets, not a good idea. Okay, pick 5, stay with your choice, and you'll be good. Yeah?
So these are the questions?
These are the topics from which questions will be asked. Okay, and that's what we're doing at the moment. We'll go through the topics. Yeah. Well, again, I'm not going to tell you the actual question, but as we go through this, you'll get some hints, pretty heavy hints.
Not the actual question, but like an example.
Yeah, yeah. Again, I'll. For instance, we'll talk about number 1, and I'll give you some idea. But we'll talk more about the general exam thing at the moment, and then we'll get to the specifics. In terms of timing, people always ask me, you know, how long should it take? It's a two-hour paper. Majority of students will finish the paper, I guess, with an hour and a quarter, hour and a half. Some will finish it quicker, some will take longer. If you have extra time, that accommodation will be obviously accommodated. We'll go down to the room downstairs, unless it's like 5 minutes to finish. I can wait a few minutes, but I can't really wait more than that. So again, we will go to the room. I think it's 600 and something downstairs. 618, 619, something like that. So that's where the extra time will take place. You can, again, I mentioned, you can answer them in any order. In terms of books, bringing books to the exam, I'm a great believer in the text. I've said that from day one. And I would say to you that, obviously, the red book, meaning the Judaica book, I'm not allowing you to bring. You can't, there's too much information in that book, which is too relevant to answer the questions. So that book is out. But any text which is a straight translation, Hebrew, English translation, could be Koran, JPS, Art Scroll, not the Art Scroll commentary, but the Art Scroll, the big green book, which you find sort of scattered around in the Beit Midrash next door. Books like that are perfectly acceptable. Even if Art Scroll has a little bit of commentary, don't worry about it. It's not a problem. Bring some sort of text, and if it's your own text, and you want to highlight a specific part of the text that you might use in the exam, please do not hesitate to do so. Okay, there's this wonderful pasuk at the end, I think, of Perek Dalet. Ish tachat gafno, tachat teinato, right, which is clearly the pasuk describing the utopian world that Am Yisrael, the Jews, were living in at that particular time. Okay, so that would be a nice pasuk to quote in the exam. Not looking, even if you want to quote it in English, I don't have a problem. No expectation of being quoted in Hebrew, but be prepared, as it were, with those types of quotations, because they really will enhance your, not only your exam, but you'll make a better impression on me. Yes?
Is it necessary to bring it?
I would say it's a very strong recommendation, right? Not to say it's absolutely necessary, but yeah, it's a pretty good idea. Okay, I can't say absolutely, but I would recommend it highly. It's good for your spiritual health. Yeah, any other comments? Yeah. Again, the end of chapter 4, there's a famous pasuk, each man sitting under his vine and his fig tree. What a wonderful image. Like on the kibbutz, right? Everyone was sitting there enjoying the peace and tranquility in Eretz Yisrael. It's like a dream. One day, please God, we'll get there again. Okay, any other questions on basic stuff? Yes. Yes, yeah. If you can, if that's your text, you want to print it out, absolutely no problem. You know, if you want to show it to me before the exam, that would even be better. Okay, but just to confirm that it's okay. It's kasher, get a hechsher, get a stamp on it from me. Yes?
It can be in English?
Yes, yeah. The text can definitely be in English, but I would, again, if you're capable of bringing the Hebrew into the exam, that would be very useful, but not something that you will be... penalized if you don't bring the Hebrew into the test, right? It's just a bonus if you can. Again, I don't know. Are you writing the test in English, or you'll be writing in Hebrew? You have to make a decision. I would say I have had tests written in Hebrew, yeah. But again, I don't know what your Hebrew. I know your Hebrew printing is great, but the essay was printed. But is it going to be your writing? If it's not going to be legible, then you may have to write in English. Yeah, up to you. I'll leave it. You make that decision. But the offer is there. I'm trying to think what else we say. In terms of finishing, oh, I always talk about, again, someone, again, this was not my daughter, but it was around her time period when someone decided to book a flight to Israel 2 hours after the exam. Sarah knows this story, this poor lady, who had an exam finishing at 3 and had a flight, not check-in, a flight, 5 o'clock from JFK. Okay, pretty impossible schedule. Leaving this room, expecting, I think she was a bit of a Trekkie. You know what Trekkies are, right? Star Trek. She wanted to be beamed from here to JFK in about 10 seconds. That was her plan. Because how she ever expected to get to JFK in less than an hour and three quarters on a Thursday afternoon, whatever it was, is beyond my understanding. She left the room at 1:20, did a 20-minute exam, compromised her grade. Don't do it. If you're going anywhere after the exam, give yourself plenty of time to finish the exam. If you've got a date, you know, don't go out at 5. Make sure you have the date at 7:30, just to give yourself time to sort of do what you have to do. I say that in all honesty because it was a shame. That time, that particular exam was really compromised. I think she ended up with a D or a C instead of an A. She was an A student, just really just did not plan her life well. A story from many years ago, but I tell it because it's kind of a warning. Yeah. You were going to say? Zam goes from chapter 1 through chapter 11. Okay, 1 through 11. All right, so without further ado, I think we're good. Let's have a look at the review sheets, which is hopefully in front of all of you. And we'll go one by one through the topics. Maybe you can chip in a little bit and help me out. Number one, the end of David's life is Teshuvah with Avishag. So the basic question we raised, right, which would be a good exam question, why does the book of Kings begin with the end of David's life? Wasn't that more relevant to be, written at the end of the book of Samuel, right? End of Shmuel, David dies, book of Kings, new king comes along, Shlomo. Why does the book of Kings begin with an overlap, essentially, of the existence of David for another one and a half chapters, very significant chapters as well? Why is that put at the beginning of the book of Kings? All right, so I hope that gives you some idea, Natalie, if that's some idea sort of thing that we're, you know, that would be the type of question. Well, it may not be the exact question I'm going to ask you, but something on those lines. What did we say? We said there's a whole issue here, beginning of the book of Melachim, about Tshuva, right? It fit very nicely. It was a nice thing to learn just before Rosh Hashanah, and it made a lot of sense. What's the whole issue of Tshuva? What is David trying to repent the sin of? Fill in the gap. Bathsheba, he never got over the fact, after he was explained to him by Natan, that's the story I'm going to be teaching next semester, so, you know, get into the Shmuel Bet class if you've never done it, because it's a phenomenal sefer. Shmuel Bet, unbelievable. King David, absolute, all the way, it's phenomenal. And the whole story there with Bathsheba is something that David seems initially not to have, seemed to have been anything beyond his ability to, as king, to marry whoever he wants. Of course, once it's explained to him by Natan in chapter whatever it is over there, chapter 12, Natan says to him, you know, the famous story of the rich man and the poor man with the sheep, etc. David realizes that he's done something terrible, and he begins the process of teshuva. And for 40 years, approximately, he is trying to do teshuva for what he did in the story of Bathsheba, right? Sending Uriah to the front line and making sure that Uriah is sort of within range of the enemy arrows, and Uriah is killed, the original husband. A lot of discussion about sort of the whole thing there, but not going into detail. But basically, David is told, even if, and this is the point that we started talking about in class, even if David is not committing an absolute sin, let's use the word legally, or in Hebrew we would say halachically, but he is certainly doing something wrong morally. And that is the issue with the beginning of the book of Melachim. We are dealing with the situation of David trying to make amends for his moral mistake, his immorality, if that's the word to describe, but it doesn't mean what it normally means. The reality of David not behaving in the way that would be expected of him when it came to the story of Bathsheba. Again, halachically, he may not be in the wrong. There were bills of divorce, etc., etc., according to most opinions, but morally, absolutely a problem. And again, we sort of mentioned, I think, and when we were learning this, if you look at Tehillim 51, Tehillim Nun Aleph, you'll find the whole heart and soul of David HaMelech being poured out literally in front of you, his reaction to what he did, and the fact that he's desperate to do tshuva. So of course, the whole story of Avishag takes on a different connotation. It says they're looking for a very pretty girl, and then it says very pretty, and then it says yafa ad ma'od, extremely pretty. And we ask the obvious question, what's going on? Why does the The pasuk seemed to sort of elevate the description from you know, sort of basic to super duper, I don't know what you want to call it. And the answer is because, again, David is determined to be in a position where he is going to be able to perform the act of teshuvah. And teshuvah means, according to Rambam, okay, and this is on the handout that I gave you, almost the first handout, that Rambam explains that teshuvah is where you're in a similar position to where you were when you committed the sin, right? And the Rambam talks about an act of immorality, having an affair or things like that. And the Rambam says if you're in a similar position and the second time round you don't commit the sin, then you have performed an act of teshuvah. And interestingly, the Rambam gives that example of what teshuvah means. All the rabbis are mystified. Why does Rambam pick an example? Why doesn't he just say, you know, you ate treif and now you're in a position where you can eat kosher? Make it simple. Why do you have to talk about morality and affairs and all the rest of it? And the answer is, my suggestion is that is what Rambam learns from the story of David and Avishag. David is teaching us about teshuvah, the most basic level of teshuvah, when you find yourself in a position of being compromised the second time, or compromising yourself and not allowing it to take place. So that is number one, the end of David's life. We added that in the discussion of David being mentioned at the beginning of Sefer Melachim, it sets the tone for the whole book. Somebody explain to me, what did I mean by that? What is the tone of Sefer Melachim? Kings going up and kings going down. What's happening when the kings go down? In most cases, they disappear from the scene, but there are a few good ones. What is Sefer Melachim always about? The challenge of the kings of Israel is, instead of going wrong, to go right. What does it mean to go right? To do right, do good, and in certain cases, if necessary, to do teshuvah. Teshuvah is the theme, in my opinion, really one of the strongest themes of the whole history of the kingship of Israel. All right, well, looking at a period when most of the kings were not particularly memorable. They were certainly memorable for what they did, but should not be remembered for what they did. Okay, when you get to sort of a certain point in the history of the kings of Israel, it gets pretty graphic, and it's really not a very nice thing to be reminded of. Nevertheless, the theme of the book of Kings is a constant battle of trying to bring the not only the king of Israel, but the whole nation back to God. Certain kings do it. Chizkiyahu does it. Yoshiyahu, Josiah does it, but not many others. And most of the kings are really spending most of their time taking the Jewish people and themselves away from Hashem. Starting with Yeravam, the gentleman that we already sort of got introduced to right at the end of chapter 11, the end of the semester. So I think it's important to understand that David is there at the beginning, sort of struggling with the issues of tshuva, because that sets the tone of the whole book. Tshuva is a theme in Sefer Melachim, how to do tshuva, trying to do tshuva in situations where, unfortunately, most of the problem was created by themselves. How did they get out of it? Most kings did not even manage remotely to do this, but there were one or two that struggled and did achieve some sort of repentance. So again, I think it's important to understand that element in the book of Melachim. The whole story of David is there to set the tone for the whole of Sefer Melachim. It's a suggestion. I haven't seen it written anywhere, but I think it makes sense to me. I think it's a relevant point to be made. Okay? Any questions on number one? Any comments? Yes, Ali.
Just a quick question. Do you need to know, like, how David deals with the children?
How he deals... Yeah, that's one of the things that comes up in the whole issue. I didn't put it on the list, but if you wanted to make some sort of reference to the whole rebellion of Adonijah and why his kids rebelled against him, if that would be relevant in any specific question, then one of the things you could talk about is the way that David, in his lifetime, did compromise the palace, certainly his private life, right at the expense of his kids. What he ended up doing is running a kind of massive nursery in the palace, okay, because of all the women that were pregnant because of they were taken captives. Right? Remember, we explained the whole story. Sorry, the
consequences of
king. Well, not the only consequence really was that things just went from bad to worse. If things could possibly get worse after King Menashe and people like that, it did. It got worse. To the point, unfortunately, which is obviously the end of Malachim Bet, which is the destruction of the temple. Okay? Hashem says it's either the people or the Bayit, and in the end it's the Bayit, the people survive, but the house is destroyed. And that's been Jewish history, unfortunately, ever since. Second temple, the same thing. Yeah.
Where is
the sound of the Malachim? In which, when, for number one?
Yeah.
Right at the beginning, literally the first four psukim. Okay?
Yeah,
I'll say as we go along, but it's Kings 1, chapter 1, verse 1 through 4, I think it is. And then you've got the rebellion of Adonijah. I didn't do much in terms of review on the rebellion of Adonijah. It may come into, you know, sort of a bigger question if you want to introduce it. We did do an analysis of Nechama. We went with Nechama Leavitz on looking at the different versions of the rebellion, but, you know, it's not on the list. So I'm sticking to the list for the moment. Any questions, please? Yeah. Sorry, again? Yeah.
So, one was
Yoshio, and the other was Hezekiah. Those were the two good guys. And in a long history of over 400 years, it's not particularly encouraging when you only have two or three good kings. There were, in the south of Israel, there were a number of them. Yoshaphat and Asa, you know, all the ones that were nearer to the time of David. But after that, even in the south, it got pretty bad. In the north, by the year 700, which is not very long, they were taken into exile. They were gone, right? The 10 tribes. I mean, that's the sad history. God says it to us over and over again. It's not about my Torah sort of criticizing you. It's about you following the rules and everything will be fine. It's you bringing it upon yourself, either the good, the bracha, or the klala, right? Famous thing. It's still true, I think, even to this day, but that's the way it goes. Anything else on number one? Otherwise, I'm moving on rapidly to number two. Number two, the conflict between the two persona of Shlomo, King Shlomo and Reb Shlomo. We already started noting at the end of chapter 1, right at the end of chapter 1, so it's talking about the last two or three psukim of chapter 1, that when Shlomo is already announced as king by his father, and he's anointed, and he goes to the river, and the whole scene. One of the interesting things is how he deals with Adonijah, his half-brother who rebelled against everybody. The half-brother Adonijah rebelled and the rebellion was put down, not with Adonijah being killed, but Adonijah being warned. And Adonijah is warned that if you stay out of trouble, keep your head down, as it were, keep your nose clean, or any other expression that you want to add to that particular list, everything will be fine. You'll live to a long and happy old age, and you'll even retire. You know, you'll be able to go and live in wherever, Netanya, and have a wonderful retirement. If you do not, however, keep yourself out of trouble, then trouble will be waiting for you. And that was Shlomo's speech to his brother, half-brother, different mothers, remember? But the reality was that, I think this is important, during that whole discussion, it doesn't talk about Melech Shlomo. It says Shlomo talking to his brother. And I pointed out, in the chapters, really from the beginning of Shlomo, end of chapter 1, right through to chapter 11, which we finished last week, the suggestion I want to make is that there are two personas, two characters contained in Shlomo HaMelech. Number one is the king character, the character of Melech. And the one is what I've called Reb Shlomo, the more rabbinic, the more halachic sort of person. The Gemara says there were many laws which the Bet Din of Shlomo brought into existence. The law of Eruv, right? Every one of us benefits, I hope, from Eruv that you have in your different communities where you live. And that whole arrangement of having an Eruv was invented originally, was given over by the Bet Din of Shlomo, as far as I remember from various sources in Gemara. And that in itself is interesting. There is definitely a halachic component to Shlomo HaMelech. However, I'm going to argue that very often when we see Shlomo becoming more personal or more halachically involved, that it's usually without the title Melech. It's usually with just be calling him Shlomo, which I'm going to call Reb Shlomo. He has that kind of, you know, sort of essence of rabbinic personality, right? And that we see also in the way that he deals with his brother in that very unfortunate situation he has with Adonijo, that he doesn't call, he's not called in that interchange at the end of chapter 1. He's not called Melech Shlomo, he's actually just referred to as Shlomo, because again, it's very personal. He's talking to his brother. Sorry?
When
Adonijo, right at the end of chapter 1. And I'm going to argue right through. The biggest example to me was the beginning of chapter 11, which we saw last week, where at the beginning he's called Melech, and the last time he's ever referred to as Melech. Because as soon as he's compromised himself with his wives, etc., etc., with all the idolatry and everything else that went on, the term Melech has gone. Alright? There's no sense anymore that he is, you know, anything more than, unfortunately, you know, the regular commoner, gardener, gentleman. I mean, he disappears so quickly from our focus. You know, it's quite shocking. Because what happens is that, unfortunately, he loses that perspective. And for us, it's all falling apart. The whole difference between Melech and non-Melech, the halachic side and the kingly side, it's all sort of become history very, very quickly at that point. Without going into sort of big explanation of that, I hope that idea of two personas. And I explain, I'll just take your question in a second, the idea is reflected to me in the 21st century, in the 20th century already, with the presentation that Israel has to have in the world. There is this sense that Israel has to be part of the world community, and also part of the Jewish community. So the laws in Israel, are very, very much based around Jewish laws, certainly laws of marriage, laws of divorce, right? Various other halachot, there's a sense of Shabbat in many, many places where you go in Israel, not everywhere, but in many places. So there is that sense, that avirah, that atmosphere of the sort of religious life which is part of Eretz Israel, not everywhere. I hope one day it will be everywhere, but you know, it's getting more and more the whole time. Or we're referring in Eretz Israel to the public presentation of Israel on the world stage, right? What we would call Melech Shalom. Meaning when Israel goes and has to be represented at a funeral, as I mentioned, the famous pictures that to me still stick in my mind of the president of the state of Israel, was a religious man at the time, walking at the funeral of Winston Churchill in London. It was on a Saturday, Shabbat, and he walked about 2 miles outside the car. They sent a car for him. It's part of the group of dignitaries, but he refused to get in the car. And he was walking all the way to be part of the funeral procession. But of course, it's represented, you know, is it the ideal? But no. Being there on Shabbos, one wouldn't choose to be there for that. But he had to be there because he's representing the country, and that's the way it is presented on the world stage. There is two personas. There's a persona of the world, and there is a persona within Eretz Israel, within Israel itself. Yes, sorry.
I was just going to ask, would you say that I don't really see that halacha in the Jewish community, but there's any halacha involved in the way he deals with Adonijo? So I guess, I mean, in my mind, when you say that he has two sides, I almost think that there's
Yeah. I'm combining
the king.
I'm combining the rabbinic and the personal as one unit, because I see that as what we would expect. Shlomo's interactions with his family would be more the, I'm going to use the word, even though I don't like using it in this context, the more Jewish side of Shlomo. Right? He's Jewish. Of course he's Jewish all around. But when he's talking to the world, to the Queen of Sheba, whoever it may be, there you get the Melech Shlomo. And Melech is sometimes not going to be presented exactly in the format which we would expect a halachic presentation. Not that it's wrong, but it's different. So when he's with Queen of Sheba, or when he's talking to the world and he's giving his mashalim, I know there is a suggestion, rabbinic suggestion, it's all coming from his knowledge of Torah, but I honestly believe he was reading a lot wider than that. Right? He was reading our traditions, but he was also aware of the world traditions of philosophy and sort of the ideologies that were around it, right? Because it's clear that's what he's doing, part of the world community. So that you're right. It really is three, but I've combined into two. So you've caught me out there, but that's good. Excellent. Well done. Yes. That's chapter three. We're coming to that. That's much more Shlomo's king, because that's the big question about that whole story with the Mishpat Shlomo, that his decision doesn't seem to be halachic. Right? That's one of the big proofs that I would also add to this discussion. When he gives a decision about cutting the baby in half, there is no rabbi in the world that's going to tell you to go and do such a thing. Okay? No, doesn't matter how long his beard is, he's never going to be able to do that. The answer is, it's not to do with halacha at that point, it's to do with melech. The king is making a decision which we would call nowadays dina de malchuta, the law of the land, which halacha recognizes. Doesn't necessarily say that this becomes Jewish law always, but in many cases it becomes the law that we as Jews have to follow. And the easiest example is when you get a red light and the law is stop. Okay? The fact is that if you decide not to stop, not only have you endangered everybody with you and yourself and the people around you, but you have essentially not fulfilled the law, which what is known halachically, but has become the law of the land, dina de malchuta, dina, the law of the land is the law which we should be keeping. Okay, and that's always a very challenging topic, very interesting topic. All right, let's go on. Number three, the hit list. Why so ruthless? Remember, David says before he dies, this one and this one and this one, don't take your eye off them. Why so ruthless? Because David, the shock about King David at the end, not only is he a tzaddik, he's such a godly person, but he's also a very practical, down-to-earth king. He understands that for Shlomo to succeed, he's either got to keep the enemies of the king well, behind sort of some sort of almost prison arrangement, not really prison, but exile, like they did in Russia. They had these famous towns of exile. All right, they also had this in Israel. They had Ir Miklat, right, which is a sort of similar idea. The idea is keep your enemies either well locked up, well away from you, and if necessary, if they are given certain conditions which they don't fulfill, then as king, you have the permission, the kingly law, which is recognized also in Halakha, of Moreid B'Malchut. Once they become a rebel, then the king is allowed to initiate the process of execution. Pretty shocking. So we have in chapter 2 this idea which comes through on three occasions. It comes through with Adonio, it comes through with Yoav, and I've got it here also with Shimi Ben Gera. They all are looking for some sort of amnesty with Shlomo, but Shlomo says yes, but there are conditions. And particularly with Shimi, the condition, remember, was not to leave Yerushalayim under any circumstance, and Shimi does leave Yerushalayim. He thinks that it's a flimsy situation which Shlomo will not get upset with. And Shlomo, of course, says to him, you broke the rule. I am now, as Melech Shlomo, I have to announce your execution. And it's very difficult with Shimi, particularly because what was Shimi's relationship to Shlomo? He was his Rebbe. And that is so difficult. Right? And again, I've been asked this question, I think it was asked online a number of years ago, when somebody listened to the Shir online and said, but you said Shimi was his Rebbe. So in which case, what's going on here in terms of their relationship, right? Why would David make Shimi the Rebbe if Shimi was so critical of David? And the answer is very simple, right? You keep your friends close, and unfortunately we say, keep your enemies even closer. To keep an eye on them. Okay, that's a political reality. You don't want your enemies to sort of just disappear into the woodwork and then come back at you without you knowing what they're getting up to. So Shimi seems to fall into that category of being watched by David, making sure eventually that Shlomo would also be careful, and when the opportunity arises, as it does with him and with Yoav, to take the necessary steps to make sure that they are no longer a problem. And this is shocking. Yoav is David's nephew, Shlomo's cousin. Shimi is also very significant in the life of Shlomo. And obviously Adonio is half-brother. And all of them, in the end, are treated in the same way because they do not abide by the rule which is established by David, which gives permission to Shlomo to say to them, keep this rule, you don't keep it, you bear the consequence, you bring it on your head. Domo Barosho Seinivrit. His blood is upon his head. Yeah. Sorry? Eviatar is not killed, but he's sent away. He's part of it, but he's treated a bit more lightly for reasons that I think we spoke about there. There's a suggestion it may be the same Eviatar that we've seen before. Yeah, there's a whole bit of background, but not really the one to worry about so much. That's number three. Political asylum is something which seems to be part of the whole discussion here. When when Adonio and Yoav both go into the Mishkan to try and save their skins by going near the Mizbeah, the suggestion in the Gemara is that this was a form of what we would call nowadays political asylum, being in a place where you can't be killed. And of course the problem is that Yoav doesn't get it right, he's in the wrong place and in the wrong situation, and doesn't save him from the sword of Benayo, the head of the army, as commissioned by Shlomo. Okay, so they're killed. So that's number three, the relationship with Shimi, as we just spoke about. Number four, looking at the time. Mishpat Shlomo, right? Why not use halacha as a guy? So what did we say? Let's go through the scenario very quickly. Two women have babies, Rochel and Leah. Or let's put it the other way around. I'm always confused by switching around the names. We've got Leah and Rochel. Okay? Leah has a baby, pick a day of the week. This is, by the way, chapter 3. Okay? This is all chapter 3. The Mishpat Shlomo. Famous. Leah has a baby on... What day of the week are we going to... Civilize, right? Monday. So you don't have to work at weekends. She has the baby on Monday. And the other lady, Rachel, has the baby 3 days later on... Thursday. Okay? Monday, Thursday. Very convenient. The problem is that we're told they are Isha, Nashim Zonot. They're not particularly the highest grade of individual in the community. They are harlots, prostitutes. And basically what seems to be going on there, whether again, Midrash has got a whole take which we didn't really go into. You can read that for yourselves. But basically what's going on is that both of them have babies, and unfortunately a tragedy that one of the babies dies. The baby that is alive is in the hands, let's say, of Rachel, the woman who had the second child, but Leah, the first mother, is coming along and saying, the baby's mine. What happened was that Rachel's baby died because the baby was smothered by the mother. That's the story. And as a consequence, what did Rachel do when she saw her baby was dead? She switched the baby, switched the child. So instead of Rachel having her child in her arms at this point, who does she have? She has, in fact, Leah's child. And Leah wants the baby back. All right? No DNAs, no wristbands or anything like that, which is why that's all done. A major thing that they do today in hospital is because of all these things. These things do happen even in the modern world. Unfortunately, the famous cases of this. Babies got swapped at birth. The bottom line of it is that each woman is essentially claiming the baby is hers. Rachel is holding the baby. Leah is claiming the baby is hers. So the Mefarshim say when Shlomo comes to a conclusion, an act of complete wisdom and novelty by saying, bring me a sword to try and determine who the real mother was, which was very clever. Because one woman says, I don't care if the child dies, better that, doesn't belong to anybody. The other mother says, don't do it. Right? You know, sort of, it's clear from Shlomo who the real mother is. But we ask the obvious question, this is not a halachic decision. Nowhere in Shulchan Aruch will you find any rabbi being told to bring a sword or whatever into the Beit Mishpat, into the courtroom, and do what Shlomo told them to do. So, what happened to halacha in that situation? I think, if you remember, what we said is essentially that there is a reason why the halacha was not relevant in that situation, did not come in, right? Because on the Monday, we know that, that when Leah had the baby, we says there were many people in the room, okay, so everybody knew about it. Thursday, when Rachel had the baby, very few people. In fact, it says one person was there, and that was Leah. So the whole question of Rachel claiming the baby is hers is now not so straightforward, because Leah can say, who says you had a baby in the first place? It's only me, because nobody else was there. So I'm now saying this is not your baby, but this is in fact my baby. So Leah can come along and take the baby According to halacha, it's called hamotzi mechavero, alav haraya. Possession is, what's the phrase? 9/10 of the law, right? And if you've got possession of the child, that is a claim, but in this case, Leah can claim, I can take the baby away from you, because the only reason you have possession is because of me. Why? Because I'm the only one who said that you had a baby in the first place. So in which case, Leah has seemingly a good claim. Halachically, Leah wants to take the baby away, and Rachel wants to hold on to the baby. Says Shlomo, I can't decide halachically in this case what to do, because it's a bit of a stalemate. Bring me a sword and let's see what happens. Okay? So look over the note on that. You've got a whole page handout on that with the case sort of stage by stage. And again, we didn't decide who eventually the mother was. It's almost irrelevant. In the end, it's the process of trying to find out who the mother was, which is really the whole essence of the story. Not going with halacha, but going with what I'm calling the law of Shlomo, the law of the king. Dina de Mele, Dina de Malchuta, the law of the king, which becomes very significant. Yeah.
What's the phrase you said? Possession is not...
Possession is normally 9/10 of the law. If you go into court and you have got possession of a very expensive, whatever it may be, then it's very difficult to extract it without excellent proof. Right? There's a very interesting film that came out about 3 years ago. 3 or 4 years ago, about a true story of a woman who tried to claim back a painting, right, from the Austrian government, which had been stolen by the Nazis during the war. Woman in Gold. Very good story. The painting is on show in New York. You can actually see it. Klimt. Klimt is the artist, and it's famous. Famous painting. And the trouble with the court case, and it drags on until they manage to, you know, get the Austrian government to admit it, is that they claim possession. They say that, you know, we've got the thing, it's been in our museum for 30 years, you know, what are you coming along saying it's yours? Why didn't you come along, you know, a long time ago? One of the arguments in court. And it's an argument which would happen also in halachic bet din as well. Same issue, the issue of possession. So it's not very far-fetched, it's quite real. But that's a good example in the modern world of trying to extract from someone else who has possession of the item. How do you go about getting your item back? Right? In this case, the baby. How do you get the baby back? Okay, that's number 4. Any questions? Mishpat Shlomo, very famous. The wisdom of Solomon, judgment of Solomon. It's always quoted all the time. Motzi mechavero, alav haraya. If you get that phrase in the exam, it will be translated for you. Okay, so if you do get that phrase in the exam, dropping a little hint over here. If you do get that phrase in the exam, Shira didn't listen. No, you did get the hint. If you do get the phrase in the exam, it is translated for you, but don't forget it. It's all about possession. Okay? Motzi mechavero. I want to take something away from you. Alav haraya. I've got to prove it. I've got to have witnesses, I've got to have documents, I've got to have the whole works. Otherwise, you're holding on to it, it's yours. Okay, and that's the way it works. That's, a principle in secular law as well as in Jewish law. A lot of Gemara about that. You know, it comes up in Gemara the whole time. So that's chapter 3, which is number 4 on the page. Any questions on Mishpat Shlomo? We'll go on. All right, number 5. Shlomo's government. Yes, Ilona. Yeah, I mean, that, read about that. In other words, if you read it up and you want to bring that in, that's fine, because there is a lot to say about that.
We didn't talk specifically about that on that.
No, we didn't talk about that, because again, you know, they're different. A lot of people see this as the two women not really being anything more than two angels, right? Or two messengers from God testing Shlomo's ability to judge. So they're not for real. Okay, so maybe the whole story is not for real. So there's different approaches, different midrashic approaches. I didn't want to get into that because it really does make the thing a bit more complicated. I think the basic issue I wanted to deal with was the halachic discussion which we've just had. Okay, so I think that's important. Number 5, Shlomo's government. This is something which I think is really, really significant. The palace, the Abba Benel. One of the things I hope that came out of this course for everybody is a better awareness, number 1, who the Abba Benel was, okay, not just the name of a very nice wine, but it's a bit more than that. If you know the Abarbanel company, some of you may know it. No, nobody's drunk Abarbanel wine. Maybe you have. It's a really good wine. Comes from, I think it's the Italian one. The issue with Abarbanel is that he lived in the 1400s, was very high up in the Spanish government, and amazingly, when he talks about Shlomo's style of government with all the officers and the civil servants and the secretary of this and the director of that, he says this is Kamosh Yesh Lanu Hayom, just as we have today in Spain. And he makes parallels between Shlomo's government, which was in the year 900, approximately 900 BCE, long time ago, and the government of Spain, which was in the 1400s, 500 years ago. So imagine how sophisticated Shlomo was to have made a form of government in an ancient world, as we said, which was so outside of Eretz Israel and outside of that influence, was basically going through, I think it was still the Stone Age, if I'm not mistaken. They were still living in caves and all the rest of it. Right? So here we're talking about tremendous sophistication. Number five, Shlomo's government and his palace. How many people did he feed every day? How many cornflakes did he get through? What was the magic number of people? Right? Abarbanel tells us. It wasn't in the hundreds, it was in the thousands.
Wasn't it like 5,000?
It was many more. 60,000 people every single day. Okay, he had the crowd coming out of the Yankee Stadium for breakfast every single day. How incredibly challenging that must have been for the waffle people and for the pancake people. I mean, I'm just trying to put a spin on it. How many cornflakes did he get? I mean, it blows the mind. Absolutely. How many eggs? How many egg stations did he have? Right, just to make the boiled eggs every day, or to the scrambled eggs. I mean, it's just beyond belief. I don't know what to say. These numbers are just so above and beyond. Yes, Mira.
Is there anything else you know specifically, like, except for like the fact that Barnell compared it to his and like things?
Yeah, just the whole style of government, how incredibly organized it was, and particularly the thing that I like was the economics of it. The fact that his government was established in such a way to bring economic life to Eretz Israel. What did he do? He divided the country into 12 areas, right? Like cantons, like you have in Switzerland, 12 different, well, I suppose you would say like states that you have in America, the original 13 states. So you have 12 states. And each area, each state would be supporting the palace 1 month every year. He had a special person in charge, and every month they would come to the palace with their goods. The palace in Yerushalayim would be supporting them, giving them money, etc. They would go away with what they've sold, and obviously that was the beginning of a basic economy of buying and selling, etc. They would then go and spend their money on things that were being made around the country, and you've started a whole economic cycle. Okay, supply and demand, etc., etc. Those who study economics will know what I mean. Yeah.
You referred to the Spanish government being very organized.
Yeah, yeah. Abarbanel says so much about his own experience in Spain, which makes it so fascinating that he can compare an ancient biblical world to his world in Spain, which really was quite sophisticated. 1400. Much of what the Abarbanel writes about government is still with us this very day. The sort of people that you have, which are officers mentioned in the whole story, and that of course is chapter 4 and chapter 5 of Malachim, those chapters deal with people that we would recognize today as members of government in the 21st century. Advisors and people in charge of the army, people who are more in charge of the sort of the religious side of things, you know, various officers of different things, the tax collection, you know, the Chancellor, the Shtekel, whatever, Secretary of the Treasury, as they call it here, whatever it may be, all of these things are referred to in Shlomo's government. Quite extraordinary wisdom that he had, the number of people he fed. The big issue we did say, though, is that he already married many, many women, too many, more than what was allowed, too many horses, too much money. Shlomo, we'll talk about that towards the end, what his philosophy was about that. We'll come to that. Alright, so that's number five. Also with, as I said, specific reference to the Abarbanel, who does make fantastic comments about his own life in Spain. Remember, he was thrown out with the Jews in 1492, ended up in Portugal, and died in 1508. That's when he died. Number six, any question? Number five, we're going to go on. The building of the temple, unique opening ceremony, the timing, Yom Kippur. We did talk about one or two issues of the Beit HaMikdash, the symbolism, incredible symbolism of the Beit HaMikdash, which is so beautiful. The way, for instance, we spoke about the Kruvim, the Kruvim of Shlomo, which was standing next to the Kruvim of Moshe, chapter 6. Okay? We're on number 6, and it's chapter 6 of the book. And the symbolism of Shlomo's Kruvim facing away, and Moshe's facing towards each other. Moshe represents the Kruvim of a world which studied Torah. What did they do in the wilderness all day? They studied. And they were facing God. God was facing them. The world of Shlomo was where they were working. They were agriculturalists. They were farmers, etc. So it's represented by them facing away. They weren't studying Torah. They weren't facing towards God every moment of the day. They were working on the farm. It wasn't they were doing something wrong. They were just doing something more in what we would call the materialistic world. Right? Shlomo represents those people in the temple. Symbolism is, not only is the, nowadays we would say, the man who studies in yeshiva and kollel, the person who is very close to God, you can be close to God being part of the society around you, working in the outside world. You can bring God into that outside world, as Shlomo did. You can bring the message, you can behave in a certain way. People will say, ah, you know something, you're very unique. Okay? You're very special. The way you conduct yourself, the way you dress, etc., etc. You're not like the ordinary sort of secretary or whatever or office person we have. And that already creates a positive impression. And believe me, it's all part of what I think we learn from Shlomo HaMelech, how to conduct ourselves in what we would call the real world. Okay, maybe the yeshiva is the real world, but that's a whole discussion for another time. The whole question of Yom Kippur, what was the problem? What was the issue with Yom Kippur? They opened the temple. How long did the ceremony take? This was a wild party. How many days? Right? 7 plus 7 together, 14 days. This is referred to in the book at the end of chapter 8. Okay? What was the problem? If the party ended on Shmini Atzeret, they went home the next day, then it started 14 days back from Shmini Atzeret on the 8th of Tishrei. They're partying to open up the temple. Right? The biggest kiddush you've ever been to in your life for 14 days. Unbelievable. Imagine how much chulun. I mean, it just blows them up. I'm not even thinking about that. The bottom line of it is that comes Yom Kippur, 2 days later, what happens next? Did they stop or did they continue partying? So two opinions. Alright, Meira, you're going to say something.
I have a question. Is it that the 14 days Yom Kippur was in the middle or 14 days?
Yom Kippur was towards the beginning, but it was certainly already the whole celebration had got going. Right? Because the Radak says quite clearly the 8th, the 9th was already celebration of the opening of the temple. The 10th, Yom Kippur. 3 days into the whole celebration. What happened on that Yom Kippur? So the Radak brings two opinions. He says one opinion is they fasted, right? And one opinion is that they feasted. So the question is, how do we understand both opinions? The fact that they fasted, I guess you can always justify by saying, well, it was still Yom Kippur, right? But does it really... Ouch. Is that okay? Does it really make sense that they would have stopped the whole celebration to do Yom Kippur? My suggestion is that the second opinion of the Radak makes more sense, that they continued partying. But that obviously throws up the question, how? It's Yom Kippur, for goodness sake. Right? Even in the time of the temple, the early days, Yom Kippur was a big feature. It was a big event. So what did we suggest? What was the possible explanation? That Shlomo, remember, was all about elevating the material to make it spiritual. So what did Shlomo say about the first Yom Kippur that was celebrated in the temple? That the materialism of what was going on, the partying, was really part of a process of elevation. Making the material into something spiritual. And if you're making it into something spiritual, then Yom Kippur becomes not a day of fasting, necessarily, but even a day of feasting. Because you're not feasting for your own personal benefit. Oh, I had a great steak last night. Right? You're feasting because you want Yom Kippur to be achieved a closeness to Hashem, which in that first Yom Kippur, only once and never again, that first Yom Kippur, the closeness to Hashem was achieved not by fasting, but by feasting. I like that little twist of English, by the way. Some of you to remember. Fasting or feasting. Okay? It's all about the little E that you add in the word. Very cute. Okay, sorry.
For the feasting analysis, didn't we also say they gave, like, Shulman said to give a lot of Korbano also, so that was another reason of why?
All the time. Correct. Shlomo's Derech, and I think I've got it on here, which is the next item, number 7. It's a segue into it. Thank you. Which is the whole idea of Shlomo taking material items of this world and elevating them. It aruta dil atata. Right? We wrote that phrase. We already started talking about it. There's not really a chapter about this. This is a kind of overview of the whole of Shlomo. Number 7 here on the page is about Shlomo's way of serving God. Shlomo's got a dilemma. Now, this interesting, very simple dilemma that how can I ever be like my father? My father David was so godly and was so close to Hashem, right? To say that I could just copy him and be like him is actually quite, how should we say, almost a chutzpah. It's almost saying, you know, I can achieve what my father achieved. It's not going to happen. So Shlomo decided, I've got to do my thing my way. How does he do it my way? By turning it around. Instead of bringing the heavens down to earth, he wants to bring the earth up to the heavens. He takes materialism and turns it into the most spiritual thing that he can. So for Shlomo, taking a situation of feasting on Yom Kippur makes perfect sense. Because for that 1 year when things, that whole event was the highlight of the spiritual focus of Shlomo HaMelech, what he was aiming towards, what he was meant to do, to build the temple, etc., then taking all of that celebration around opening the temple and making it holier by dedicating it all to God and all the sacrifices and the korbanot, etc., etc., it's all part of Shlomo's style, which is to take the material world and elevate it. Itarut, to stir it up, milatata, from below. David was mila'ela, David was from above. La'elo, la'elo, was things that we say in the Kaddish, coming down from heaven. For Shlomo, it was elevation from below. And that, I think, is really significant to bear in mind, the difference between the way Shlomo served Hashem and the way David served Hashem. Of course, this leads Shlomo into a very dangerous situation when it comes to his marriages and to his finances. What did Shlomo do which was above and beyond what he was allowed to do? Instead of marrying 18 wives, how many did he end up with? This incredible number, nice round number, 700 by marriage, by proper marriage, we would say, chuppah, etc. Okay, 700 wedding receptions, that's pretty frightening. And 300 what we call concubines, which basically means that he would just live with them, they would have relations, and they would become his wife, which was allowed for the king, something we don't do today. And as a consequence of those events, Shlomo was clearly making a statement that he was trying to elevate, trying to take the whole material allowance that the king had and expand it and increase it. And his logic for this was very simple. I'm told the reason is because having too many wives may influence the king to go bad, to go become idolatrous. Say, what happened to me? I'm Shlomo HaMelech. I'm in control. I am so intellectually blessed by God that I can control my mind, can control my heart. What was the big chiddush at the end of the whole story? What came out? What was really in control of Shlomo? Not his mind, but Nisheva, his heart. His heart controlled his mind, right? And that is the big deal. Instead of his mind being in control to the point where he would never be affected by his heart, it turned out Shlomo was, put it very bluntly, like every other man ever been created ever since, which is that he can be influenced emotionally, even if intellectually he believes one thing, emotionally, with the right influence, he can be turned around to the point where Shlomo is accused of building idols. Say the rabbis, did he really build an idol? So what's the answer? They say he didn't build it, but he allowed it. If you allow something, as they say in English, aiding and abetting, you've aided something to happen, it's as if you did it yourself. So that's how shocking it gets. So again, Shlomo, we're almost out of time. So this is the whole story of Shlomo serving Hashem as opposed to David. I'm going to finish very quickly. Number 8, story of Malkat Sheva, the Queen of Sheba. The riddles, please check that particular story over again. The 3 riddles, the 4 riddles, what they represent. I'm going to go through them again. The boys and whatever, boys and girls going after the candies. And if you remember all the story, what is it all about? Malkat Sheva is saying, Manishtana, why are you different from everybody else? We all look the same, brotherhood of man, and says Shlomo Melech, no. Reality is that there are basic differences being created by God, and one of those differences, Lahavdil, Bein, Yisrael, La'amim, we are just built differently, right? We have different priorities, we do things differently. Not we're better than anybody else, not that you're worse than anybody else, it's just we're different. And we need to respect our differences. That, I think, is really a strong message. The downfall of Shlomo, why, how, the lessons. Again, a lot to do what we just said. Shlomo was pushing a boundary here which really was not allowed to be pushed. Shlomo was told by God, if you kept the rules, kept the laws, everything will be fine. Says Shlomo, well, I'm going to push it a little bit further than, a lot further than it was allowed, either to show that, you know, I'm in control, to show the world that maybe only for me, but for nobody else, only I'm the only king that can actually do this, nobody else should ever do this. But of course, by making an example like that, he brings the whole situation down upon his head. He creates a separation. The separation that Shlomo creates is eventually the separation between the north of Israel and the south, which never comes back together again. Shlomo's great intellect, why push the envelope? We just spoke about that. The whole question of the epitaph of Shlomo HaMelech. He's never mentioned in our tefillah. David ben Yishai, but never Shlomo ben David. He's not in the Ushpizim. We don't invite him to the Sukkah. We don't have anything to do with him when we make Mishabera. Mishabera, David, Rivka, Rocha, Valea. Avram, Sara, etc., all the Mishaberas that we make. Never mention Shlomo. Right? He's just not there. Because in the end, with all of the amazing things and the legacy of Shlomo, Shir HaShirim and Mishle and Kohela, all of that put to one side, the reality of Shlomo was that he was, I suppose you would say, too smart. He was too clever and pushed in directions which he should never have gone into. And of course, if David had been around, he would have held him back, but David was not there to help him. Yes, Meira.
Can you go over for the Queen of Sheba, like what the different riddles, like?
Yeah, if we really don't have the time, you really need to look at that in your notes. But the basic thing was, all the different riddles, remember about the baby breastfeeding, the one about Lot, the daughters, etc., the one about the children dressed in the same clothing, and the men circumcised and uncircumcised, right? And all of them really harping on the same question. Manishtana, why do you claim to be different if you all look the same? The answer is because we are essentially different in who we are. This is what Shlomo is teaching the Queen of Sheba. The shocking thing is, remember what we said at the end, she goes home with a souvenir. What's the souvenir? Put it very bluntly, right? She goes, I'm pregnant. She says, I've got to have a child from Shlomo. And she conceives a child with him, which she takes back to Ethiopia with her. And that's why Shlomo is a very popular name with Ethiopians this very day. Ethiopian Jews are built around the name Shlomo. How the operation to get the Ethiopian Jews out of Ethiopia was known as Operation Shlomo, right? 1991, 92, whenever it took place. Again, the whole thing with Shlomo, the downfall of Shlomo is essentially Malkat Sheva chapter 10 and the downfall of Shlomo chapter 11. Again, very, very challenging, no question about it. Shlomo Melech is one of those characters. As I said, remember right at the beginning, the greats. We have such great people in our history, but what is so great about our history is that we don't hide the challenges. We don't make them supermen. Superman is nice, makes a nice movie. But we don't have Superman. We have great human beings. But by definition, being a great human being means you also can be a person with faults. Even Shlomo, with such a great intellect, such a great mind, was not the ultimate be-all and end-all of Jewish life. I guess the biggest message from Shlomo is, follow the rules, everything is fine. You don't follow the rules, then you take your chances, because what Shlomo proved is that even though he wanted to be in control of, intellectually control everything's going on around him, It just wasn't going to be because he wasn't following the rule. The rule was limiting him, and he was breaking that rule and going to an extreme. 1,000 wide, 40,000 horses, some say even more. Whatever it was above and beyond, and in the end, it worked against him. It's very sad because 40 years, Tachat Gafno, Tachat Teinato, that wonderful pasuk, describing the Jewish life in Israel, never has been like that ever since. For 40 years, no enemies, all the political marriages, all the people stayed away, because he was married to all their daughters, Egypt stayed away, and all the rest of it, and the peace in Israel, the tranquility was beyond belief. And I guess that's also a message for us. Please God, we'll get back to that stage one day. I want to say just in the sort of show of gratitude, how much, again, big group. These were very big groups this semester. But with that, it really is inspiring that, you know, you come away, I hope, with something. You come away with a bit of a sense of knowing the people that we come from, where we come from. We get to know them just a little bit better. We know a little bit more about Dovin, much more, I hope, about Shlomo. To know who we are as Jews, where we're coming from, and to take the lessons, to learn the lessons of history, to build our priorities on the basis of what we've learned. Because all of this, I really believe, is irrelevant. You know, especially when we go out into the outside world, that whole concept of making it a bit sort of, you know, making that impression that as a Jew, particularly as an Orthodox person, one should make. And that's a real challenge. But please God, it's something I hope you all achieve. I want to say thank you to everybody. It's been really inspiring. Really, really mean that, because I learned so much from your essays particularly. Have been phenomenal. If there are any essays still to come in, please let me know what's going on. But I think we're pretty much up to date with almost everybody. Any questions, please don't hesitate. Send your emails. I would, again, try to get back to you, Bezrat Hashem, within 24 hours. Remember, next week we're not meeting on Thursday. That is reading week, and that's, as far as I'm concerned, Kadosh, holy, dedicated for reading. Have a wonderful Shabbat, everybody, and good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.